Last week we started the third of the Rambam's 13 principles or foundations, and that is the notion of physicality or incorporeality, the notion that God is not physical and can't be described in any kind of physical form. But the notion of physicality in all of its facets is essentially part of that which God created, and therefore not part of God himself. One of the logical arguments, we didn't discuss the logical or philosophical background context to that idea, but the Rambam employs in his philosophical writings several arguments to demonstrate this idea. One of them is the idea, is the notion that if we go back to principle number one describes God as having created all that exists, all of the physical world. And it's a postulate of the notion of creation that you can't be bound by the limitation of that which you create. If God can create physical world, if God can create physicality, then he himself cannot be a product of that which has not been created, or that which he creates. So therefore, the assertion is that anything physical is part of that which came into being at a finite moment, and God, by virtue of having put that into motion, certainly cannot be a product of that which did not exist. So there is a certain logical argument that leads the Rambam to this position. God can't be physical in any way. Any physical dimension, any physical attribute is part of the laws of physics and the laws of nature, and would have come into being at that moment of creation. Since God predates that, since God created that, he certainly cannot be bound or defined in terms of what that creation is. That is, that's sort of the logical or philosophical context that stands behind this principle. In our discussion of that idea just to review briefly what we discussed last week, we talked about the fact that all of the Torah's descriptions of God in physical terms, when the Torah talks about God's outstretched arm and strong hand, when the Torah talks about God being angry, God flaring his nostrils, so to speak, Vayichar af Hashem, or God seeing, or God hearing, all of these terms are anthropomorphic, and they are essentially metaphors to help us understand the way in which God interacts with the world, the way in which God enters into some kind of momentary relationship. And if we go back to the first principle, where we talked about the relationship between God and the world, that's essentially what we are describing. When God, so to speak, gets angry, it's because his interaction with the world at that moment is in a form of judgment or din, which we would translate or perceive in our frame of reference as anger. When God, when we pray and God responds, we talk about God hearing our prayers, even though God doesn't have ears to hear, and he doesn't hear in a physical sense, but the notion of his interrelationship with us through a response to our prayers is described from our perspective as hearing. It's interesting to note in the listing of the animamins, which we have at the end of davening, there's a list of the 13, a summary of the 13 principles of faith in a sort of poetry, animamin be'emunah shleima, I trust with a perfect trust. So the third one reads, she'abarei yitbarach shmo eino guf, that this creator is not physical, ve'lo yasiguhu masige haguf, nor can anything physical comprehend him. V'lo yasiguhu masigeh haguf. Nothing, it is not, nothing afflicted by, he's translated it differently, they've translated it as he is not affected by physical phenomena. But lahasig means to, has two meanings. Lahasig means to catch up to something, right, to affect something. Lahasig also means to understand, to comprehend. Lo yasigehu masigeh haguf are those which are physical. Physical beings can't comprehend the notion of a non-physical being. It's beyond our frame of reference. We have no frame of reference with which to describe it. We describe everything in terms of our experience. And that gets back to the first idea which we spoke about, the very first principle, namely that the way in which we describe God is not by describing what God is, but by describing the relationship we have with God at any given time. And this principle is no different. To describe God as being incorporeal or not physical means that whenever the Torah needs to describe the relationship between man and God, it does so in terms that our, from our frame of reference, namely non-physical terms, namely physical terms, even though we know that they are a poor reflection of the reality of what God truly is. That is where we left off, I believe, at the end of our shiur last week. Now, of course, there are there's one critically important phrase that appears in the Torah that seems to fly in the face of this principle. And it's that phrase which we need to understand. And I am referring to, it's actually not a term about God as much as it's a term about man. The center point, right, the verse, the story of creation that seems to challenge this principle is that description of God, of man, as having been created B'Tselem Elokim, in the image of God.
The image of the qualities.
So now we'll have to define. So now we have to define the term, right? That's exactly it. That's why translations are a challenge, because the moment you translate something, you interpret it. So I could translate Tselem in many different ways, each way being a different meaning, and some will have raised this question and some will not. But on the face of it, God says to creation, or he says to the angels, Naaseh Adam B'Tselmeinu Kidmuteinu. See if it's in the center. Right. The Torah describes the man as being created B'Tselmeinu Kidmuteinu, or Tselem Elokim and Dmut Elokim. Two words. Which we would normally translate in normal Hebrew speech, Tselem referring to a form, Dmut also being referred to a form. The word Dmut actually comes from the root Dome, which simply means
similar.
So we share some similarity with God. That similarity is the Tselem. And similar verses throughout creation, throughout the story of creation, Vayas Elokim et Adam, B'Tselem Elokim asat Adam, man, Ele toldot Adam b'yom hibaram, B'Tselem Elokim asato. It's at least three different places in the story of creation where man is described as being created. It's Tselem Elokim. And on the face of it, Tzelem Elokim seems to mean in the image of God, compared to every other part of creation which is not created by Tzelem Elokim, we are. And if we look at that from a physical standpoint, then we run the risk of, then we run the challenge to the principle of God being not physical. So we have two questions that we have to answer. Number one is, what is Tzelem Elokim if it's not physical? That's the second question. First question is, does this challenge the Rambam? And assuming that it doesn't, what exactly is the Tzelem Elokim with which we are created? And this is really the anchor, the center point of this discussion. So if you turn to the source pages that I've given you, they are here if you don't have one. The first place we have to start is obviously the Rambam himself, because if we're studying the Rambam, then our question has to be answered first and foremost by the Rambam in his own words. And from there we will expand into a number of areas. The Rambam deals with this question specifically. He deals with it in two places. Here in the Laws of Foundations of the Torah, in chapter 4, again I am on what is at the top of the page, it says Amud 16, tiny little letters. I am on a page that looks like this. The page that has the sources numbered, 1, 2, 3, etc. Source number one is the Rambam and the Laws and Foundations of the Torah, chapter 4. And there, the Rambam writes the following. Nefesh kol basar hi tsurato shenatan lo ha'el. The nefesh of every person, of every flesh, is the tsura that God has provided him. Okay? So tzura, now the Rambam is using terms that in medieval Hebrew have certain meaning. Terms change over time. That is the nature of language, that words take on different meaning in different generations and in different contexts. Certainly true in any language, English no exception. That is the nature of change of time. So the word tzura in modern Hebrew means drawing or picture or form. In the medieval Hebrew, it means the exact opposite. It means the inner core, the essence of what something is. That's an interesting change in use. Whereas in modern Hebrew, it means the exact opposite of what it means in medieval Hebrew. Not the first time that words have changed not only their meaning, but 180 degrees of their meaning. The one that I like the most is the word olam. This one I've shared with you before. In the biblical context, the word olam means eternity. In rabbinic language, the word olam means world, which is physical and finite. So in a certain sense, they are opposite. Right? Olam, which is physical, and olam, meaning that which is eternal, are two opposite meanings. The word tzura here does the same thing. He's talking about that which is at the essence, the core of the human being, and he calls it the nefesh. What do we call the nefesh?
The soul.
The soul. Now, we have several words for the soul. In Hebrew, we have several words for what we call soul. We have, in English, also different words. We talk about soul, we talk about?
Neshama.
So, in Hebrew, we have neshama. What else do we have?
Ruach.
Those are the classic Hebrew terms for some kind of a notion of the soul. In English, we talk about soul, we talk about spirit. Any other terms? I think that's pretty much, I don't know, I think in English we're limited to two. In Hebrew, we have three: ruach, nefesh, and neshama. In Kabbalistic literature deals a great deal with these three concepts, and they even form the acronym of Renan. Ruach, Nefesh, and Neshama. And you'll see that in Kabbalistic literature often. Somehow they divide into different components of the soul, but whereas Kabbalistic thought assumes a consistent application of these three terms, the Rambam argues against consistency. We'll see that here. Nefesh kol basar hi tzurato, shenatan lo ha'el, v'hadat hayitera hamitzuya b'nafsho shel adam, hi tzurat ha'adam hashalem b'dato. The intellect, the additional intellect that man has, that is the essence, tzurat ha'adam, that is the real person. Intellectual capability. Ve'al tzurazu, on this essence, on this, right, we call, in the modern Hebrew we translate that as form, but for the Rambam tzura means the essence. On this essence, ne'mar b'Torah, nase adam b'tzalmeinu kidmuteinu. It was of this essence, this nefesh, this intellect, over which the Torah said, let us make man in our tzelem, klomar, that is to say, Shetielo tzura hayodat umaseget hadeot, that man should have understanding. And here maseget, I remember I said before that the word lahasig in the animam means to comprehend, because the Rambam uses it in that sense. Umaseget hadeot she'en lehem golem or golem, man's ability to comprehend ideas that have no physicality to them. I'll read that again. Man's tielo tzura hayodat umaseget hadeot she'en lahem golem. Man's ability to understand, to know, and to understand ideas that have no physicality to them. In English, we call them abstract thought. Correct. Abstract thought. Interesting phrase. In other words, for the Rambam, what contains the soul? Where is the soul contained? Where is this ruach or neshama or nefesh, whatever you want to call it? What is it? Right. It is the intellect, the intellectual ability of the human being to comprehend abstract thinking, or abstract thought. And it's interesting, if you think about the development of educational development, or child development, abstract thinking comes in a much later stage. And it's exactly, it's sort of, I don't know exactly what stage it is, for that I need the educators and the psychologists to weigh in on this conversation, but I suspect it comes slowly along the same time frame as maturity develops, bar mitzvah age, teenage years. The real ability to comprehend non-physical ideas, abstract thoughts, complex ideals. And what the Rambam is saying is that that's exactly where the neshama fits into the picture. What in rabbinic literature is the time when the Yetzer HaTov enters into a person, right, the bar mitzvah age, when they begin to be able to discern right from wrong, make decisions, and be held accountable. Before that, we're essentially physical beings. We operate by instinct. We operate by no different than the animal kingdom. We eat. Play, we engage with each other. But that which separates us from the animal world, says the Rambam, is our ability to think and to formulate abstract thought. Then he goes on to say,
I wonder what age kids are able to delay gratification. I think they can do that fairly early.
Yeah, they probably at some level can. They probably at some level can. The rabbi here is talking about much more than just delayed gratification.
Oh, I understand.
He's talking about the idea of comprehending the non-physical. I told a few of you last week, I had a very interesting experience with my four-year-old son when we were in New York last week. We were at a mall that had a carousel. My son loves carousels. They took him on one of these carousels. At the top, along the inside of the carousel, they had all these paintings. Painting of a horse, painting of a zebra, painting of different animals, different pictures. And he's identifying each one. And one of them was a painting of a sailor. Larger gentleman, black beard, down to about his chest, and a old-fashioned steering wheel of ships, you know, a big wheel with the spokes sticking out of it. Dark skies, and he's, it was clearly a picture of a sailor at sea, and he's holding the steering wheel, and he's steering. And so clearly what you see is the torso of a sailor with a beard and a ship and a steering wheel. And my four-year-old son looked up and he said, oh, there's a picture of God. Mm. Right. Now, is that abstract thinking? Mm. Right. It's very physical. And he has an image. What is God? God is running the world. So what is he? What's the image? The image is of a sailor, of a captain of a ship with a beard driving a ship. Right? That's very physical thinking. That's a four-year-old mind. That's exactly what the Rambam is trying to negate. But you need to develop intellectual development to be able to reach the stage of understanding that God is not physical, but the concept of God driving the ship, running the ship, is something which we can understand in very concrete terms. So this form of thinking develops in stages. Then the Rambam goes on to say, "Ve'eino omer al surazu hanikeret la'inayim, shehi hapeh ve'achotem alisatot v'shar roshem haguf." This is not this tzura. This concept of a person, what we call the tzura, he says, is not the way a person looks, his eyes, his nose, his cheeks, that is called shezu to'ar shma. That is the Torah's term for how one looks, how one sees. The physical appearance, says the Rambam, is to'ar. For example, Joseph, yefei to'ar. Right? Or Abraham about sorrow when they're going down to Egypt says, "Hine ati, yifat to'ar." Yifat to'ar means that you are beautiful. We in modern Hebrew we would say yafeh or yafah, but in biblical Hebrew you have to qualify that, because is it yafeh can be an internal, abstract quality. Yafeh can be an external, physical quality. Yifat to'ar is a physical quality. Now, just another example of the reversal of Hebrew words, because today in modern Hebrew, l'ta'er is to abstractly describe something. Right? When biblical Hebrew, ta'ar is a reflection of the physical form, and tzura is a reflection of the essence, the core, the inside, the non-physical. So that's actually a reversal of terminology. Nor are we talking about the type of spirit or soul that exists in every living thing, which leads a person to be able to live, to eat, to drink, to procreate, to feel. That every living beast has. So a dog feels and lives and procreates and eats and drinks. The dog has a spirit or a soul? Yes and no. It may have some life force. We would call it a life force. The Rambam calls it some kind of ruach. Right? That every animal has. It's a life force. It's not what we are referring to when we talk about the nefesh of the individual or the soul. It's a distinction between life force. In English, we and soul, if I could use those terms. Ela hadea shehitzurat ha-nefesh. But we're talking about the intellect, which is the essence of the nefesh. Ubitzurat ha-nefesh ha-katuv medaber b'tzameinu kidmuteinu. Upanim rabot tikra zot hatzura nefesh v'ruach. Many times this idea is called the nefesh. Other times it's called the ruach. Ulefichach tzirich lizeher b'shmotan shelo yite adam bahen. Shem v'shem yilamed min yano. These things have different names. The life force is called one thing, and the intellectual force is called another. One has to distinguish them. So this essentially is where the Rambam introduces the idea that these three concepts, Ruach, Nefesh, and Neshama, refer to three different components of the human soul, that two of which we share with the animal kingdom. Call them what you will. Call them Ruach and Neshama. It doesn't matter. Two of the three we share with the animal kingdom. The third makes man stand alone and unique in the creation context, and is that which links us to God. The Rambam calls it the intellect, the abstract comprehension. For the Rambam, the soul of the human being is housed in his mind. And therefore, the Tzelem Elokim, with which the human being is created, is some component that links us to God. In a sense, what the Rambam is saying is that God himself is kind of like this pure intellect, this pure knowledge, idea, value, concept. Can't describe him anything physical, but that understanding, God essentially is pure intellect. He calls it, there's another term the Rambam that's used in the Kuzari a lot. Called the Sechel HaPoel, translated often as the active intellect. Intellect that can create, that can form, that can move, that can change things. Man has a component of that in him. And he shares that with the Ribono Shel Olam. He shares that with God. That's the Rambam's definition of what Tzelem Elokim is. So in short, the Rambam, Tzelem Elokim, means that part of the human being, the soul, the spirit, that he does not share with the animal kingdom, that is pure spirit, soul, connection to God. We see it, we feel it, we manifest it in the intellect.
Where does the power of speech come in?
Oh, very interesting. Where does the power of speech come in? The Rambam doesn't talk about the power of speech. And I assume it's because, for the Rambam, the power of speech isn't necessarily the key to the soul, because every creature can communicate. Where it is a reflection is in abstract communication. Because communication between animals cannot develop into abstract thought. Now, from a scientific point of view, they'll argue simply that the brain is more developed. For the Rambam, it's more than just the fact that the brain is more developed. It is an active definition of active moment of creation. To create the mind of the human being is better, different, qualitatively different than the rest of the animal kingdom. Yeah.
What about people with a special needs, mentally retarded?
So that's where the Rambam's definition falls short, because what essentially the Rambam is saying is that there, in those individuals, there would be a deficiency in this department of the neshama. And for the Rambam, well, unapologetically, he would agree that that is the case. Mickey, you had a question?
Similar question, that individuals in this group, which we're calling humans, have different capabilities, but also in age. If the Rambam's definition fails until you're a certain age.
I'll tell you what I think the answer to the Rambam would be. We're all assuming that the notion of the soul is an absolute. You either have it or you don't. It separates us from the animal kingdom. You either have a soul or you don't have a soul. For the Rambam, I'm not sure that's the case. Precisely because the Rambam defines the soul as the intellect of the human being, I think for the Rambam you develop it. And the act of creation This is how I think I would understand in the Rambam. That you develop this soul. You develop this intellectual capability. And not for everybody is it the same. The soul can get stronger and weaker. The truth is that everybody agrees that we can have stronger souls and weaker souls. We're going to talk about that hopefully at the end of the shiur today, if not next week. It's a very important concept. You can exercise the soul. You can develop the soul. That's a critically important idea. So for the Rambam, the intellectual process of understanding, and it's not just understanding science and math and the world around us and abstract thinking, it's also understanding God. It's the exercise of trying to comprehend God, of trying to understand God. It's why the Rambam says that Moshe Rabbeinu reaches the highest level of intellect, the humanly possible, because Moshe came to the closest understanding of God, humanly possible. And the stronger the intellectual understanding, the stronger the abstract thinking, the stronger the soul of the human being is. So part of our mandate in this world for the Rambam is that intellectual exercise. And so certain people who have greater intellect and greater understanding will have a stronger soul for the Rambam. And for those who have less of that and who have less understanding and who don't develop that from there, either by choice or not by choice, but nonetheless, they would have a smaller component of this notion of neshama. It may be a difficult concept for us to swallow with our 21st century sensibilities, but that's clearly what the Rambam, I think, is saying.
Isn't it like, though, because these are intellectual, this is a linear process as opposed to abstract, which is not. It's you can be equally abstract along all points of the intellectual, you know, axis. You use the word intellect, but that means the smarter a person is, the bigger his soul.
Don't get hung up on my application of an English term of abstract thinking into the Rambam. The Rambam, the issue here is hasagat ha'elokit, is understanding or comprehension of God. And God is not physical. So to get there, you have to be able to comprehend that which is not physical. You have to reach abstract thinking. But his clearly, and he talks more than here, if you want to explore this idea in greater depth, I'll give you a source to read. I don't have time to do it in this course. But he develops this idea at length in his introduction to Ethics of Our Fathers. He has an 8-chapter essay in the introduction to his commentary on Pirkei Avot. It's called The 8 Chapters of the Rambam, Shmona Prakim. And there he develops the idea, he spends the first 4 chapters discussing exactly what each one of these terms mean. But his emphasis is clearly on intellectual thinking. And I don't mean intellectual thinking in the modern term. An intellectual being somebody who is unemotional and pure thinking and never doesn't engage in spiritual activities. Don't confuse modern terms. What we're talking about is the thought process, the use of the brain in all of its capacities and all of its functionalities to comprehend God, rather than not using our brain and not trying to go through that exercise. That's why for the Rambam, Torah learning was so fundamentally important, because it was part of that process of understanding God through the mind. And all the different various facets and formats. But it's the use of the mind for the Rambam, and this is a very Aristotelian idea. It's not hard to trace the connection between the Rambam, this idea of the Rambam, and Aristotle. This is where the Rambam's idea of the neshama is unequivocal. It is housed in the mind. For the Rambam, that's unforgiving. Others had a different take on it, and I'll show you at least 2 other approaches. But for the Rambam, it's clear that the soul lives in the mind, not in the heart. Yeah.
So therefore, the excitement of life is the growth of the soul.
What, Larry?
The excitement of life is the growth of the soul. Yeah. Anything that challenges the mind to grow and to comprehend more of God and of God's ways and of a relationship with God, and to struggle through that abstract thinking, anything that strengthens that process strengthens the soul. Anything that strengthens the body without strengthening the mind is not engaged in strengthening the soul.
Well, you
need a healthy body to be able to develop a healthy soul, but that's a separate issue, right? It's all here.
So what you're saying is the Rambam would say that an autistic child, a mentally disabled child, would have
a deficiency in this department, correct?
Even though they may be equally capable of abstract ideas.
To the extent that they are capable of intellectual thought, they have a component of this neshama. To the extent that they develop it to the understanding of God, they are deficient. Every person is at a different level.
But it's specific to understanding, it is applicable to understanding God.
I would say so, yeah, I think so. Right? The skill is abstract thinking. The application of that skill for the purpose of the soul is understanding God. To the extent that we can. The exercise of trying to understand God. Clear? Yes or no? That's what the Rambam would say. And
it doesn't necessarily exclude people who have that are developmentally disabled. They're just at a certain...
They have a deficiency in that intellectual ability, and therefore in this department.
You could have a physical deficiency.
Correct, a spiritual deficiency. Absolutely. That's not to say that they're necessarily less. It's just it's a fact. According to the Rambam, the facts are that it is the mind that we need to develop an understanding of God and relationship with God. And if I can't develop that, then I'm not going to be able to exercise that component of my soul.
People who don't develop it.
By choice. Right.
Okay.
And they are accountable for it.
Right. Okay.
Absolutely.
Who can't develop it? Who God made people who cannot develop it? And that's for a certain reason too.
That's the Ribono Shel Olam's cheshbon. I can't hold them accountable for that which they cannot do.
Right.
I can only hold a person accountable for that which he can do and chooses not to. Accountability is not... Our discussion up until this point has not been about accountability. It's been about what is and what isn't. Accountability is already a very subjective, judgmental issue, and I have not addressed the issue of accountability at all. Yeah.
It's almost like you're dealing with capacity.
Yeah, I think capacity is a good word. Now, clearly, that is one view of the soul. There are others. And I want to share with you, time permitting, an additional example of a different approach to what the soul, or what defines Tzelem Elokim. And then we'll talk about what they share in common. The Sforno, Rav Avadya Sforno, another one of the classic commentaries on this pasuk of Bitzalmenu Kidmutenu. In source number 2, the Sforno writes, what is Tzelem? When we talk about Tzelem, what are we talking about? So clearly we can't be talking about physicality. So he writes, Hu etzem sichli v'nitzchi. This is the essence of the intellectual idea. In the Middle Ages it was very common to talk about the neshama in the context of the intellect. Nitzchi is eternal. ובזה פתח הקהל יתברך פתח בתורתו לקנות ידיעה בעצמים הנבדלים בידיעת נפשנו. And in this ability, God has given us the ability to understand that which is separate from ourselves. Not an idea of abstract thinking or self-awareness. Now, a little bit of a different nuance.
Not self-centered.
Excuse me?
Not self-centered.
Right. Right. Nivdalim b'idiyat nafshenu. To understand things that are distinct. B'atzamim. To understand yidiyat ba'atzamim hanivdalim b'idiyat nafshenu. That which is separate or apart from ourselves. Now, he goes on to say, kidmutenu. There's a second term here. He translates dumut a little bit differently than selim. kidmutenu b'inyan hama'asiyot, similar to God with regards to deeds. So up until now we've talked about the mind. What the Sforno does is he distinguishes between selim and dmut, as selim referring to the intellect of the human being, and dmut, domeh, similarity, referring to similarity in action and behavior. Not only do we think like God, do we share a certain concept intellectually, but with regards to actions, we also share a behavioral pattern with God. And that Selam Elokim refers not only to the intellectual ability of the human being, but also to his behavior. Specifically, Sheyidamebam Tzat Lepamal Yeshama, that we should be similar in our actions a little bit to the heavens, Bitzad Mashem Poalim Biyadiyahu Vehakara, in that we function, we decide, we are aware of the decisions that we make. He says it again, two lines let down. We share in common with God the fact that we are creatures of choice, that we make decisions and choose our course of action. Then he says, with regards to God's choice is always good, because God is by definition good. With regards to human choice, man can choose good or evil. But the ability to choose is a unique, and choose based on values, based on ideas, based on the mind, is a unique ability of the human being. So whereas for the Rambam, the concept of Tzelem Elokim is a purely intellectual idea, the ability of the human being to comprehend God, the Sforno adds to a notion. He says that's true for Tzelem. With regards to Dmut, we have to add to the equation the notion of free choice. The soul is that which gives the human being free choice, the ability to choose their actions, the ability to behave according to ideas and decisions that are not purely instinctive, but are based on the application of the mind to the circumstances around us.
Are we going, first we're abstracting, and then we're saying that we have a notion when we understand things intellectually that we have values associated with them, like good, not good, better, and the idea that these values are godlike values, which is the choice we have to make. Like God valued or not to be?
I think they both agree that part of the idea of comprehending God means comprehending that the values that God defines for us, good and evil, right and wrong, spiritual, physical, these are all concepts that are part of the notion of godliness. So they're all it's part of that intellectual process. Where the Rambam and the Sforno differ is the Rambam talks about Tzelem Elokim as the intellectual understanding. The Rambam, the Sforno, adds one component. Tzelem Elokim houses our ability to choose and to make choices in life. And it's similar to God in our ability to act without a force upon us telling us or forcing us to behave in a certain way. Free choice. It's always described as bechira chofshit, free choice. Meaning a free of instinctive control. When we talk about free choice, what's free about it is that it has become free of instinct. Every animal chooses. A lion waiting in the hunt chooses whether or not to pounce on its prey. But it makes that choice based on instinct. We choose whether to pounce upon our prey based on values. Sometimes they're instinctive, fight or flight. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're counter-instinctive. We are creatures of choice. Good choice, bad choice, doesn't matter. But it's the choice that defines who we are.
Yep. It's more than that. We have abstract thinking. And in abstract thinking, we could believe that it was a good choice to practice euthanasia. Okay. But, and that can come out of just intellectual analysis. But we can't do that. That's not a value that we have.
We could, but that we haven't reached principles 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11 yet.
Okay.
Right? We could. At this point, the Rambam has said nothing about what kind of choices we make. Nor has the Svarna. For that we need law, for that we need guidance, for that we need direction, and that's where we introduce into the discussion principles such as God revealed the Torah and prophecy and communication between God and man. Well, we're working towards that. But based purely on the notion that God created the human being with a component of the human being being spirit, being choice, at this point, we have free choice. And again, free choice means free of, not free of consequence. What you're talking about is free of consequence. Right? Nobody says it's free of consequence. It's free of instinct. That's what Bechira Chofshit means. Just as God is free because there's nothing imposing a decision upon him, nothing imposes upon us a decision one way or the other. There are always consequences to the choices we make. That already opens up a whole new world. That the human being, that which defines the Tzelem Elokim is the way we behave. It's the fact that we have the ability to choose and to behave according to our minds, to let our minds drive our actions. Right. So, according to both these definitions, how do you translate the term Bayas Elokim et Adam Bitzalmo? God created the human being Bitzalmo. In, how would you translate the term?
God has a choice to do whatever he wants.
Yeah, so God is a creature of choice and he created creatures of choice. That's what the Svarna is saying. God is a creature of choice, created a creature of choice. Now translate this verse. Bayas Adam et Adam. Just to make life more challenging, the verse reads, Vayivra Elokim et Adam Bitzalmo, God created man in Bitzalmo. Bitzalem Elokim bara oto, Zachar unkeva bara ota. Okay, me too. Yes, I did. Okay, right. So the second half of the verse clearly talks about male, female. To suggest that that's what the first half of the verse talks about is problematic, right? But it's easy to make that mistake. God created man in His image. How? By creating him physical, male or female, and therefore the possibility of describing God. What is the image of God? The male female partnership. Well, that has given birth to, pardon the pun, that has given birth to an enormous culture around the deity as a dual male-female relationship and all of its sexual overtones. But that's not what the verse is saying. According to every Jewish commentary, the notion is dafka the opposite. Bara, zachar u'nekeva bara otam is their physicality. What is Vayivra Elokim et Adam Bitzalmo Betzalem Elokim Bara Oto? So how would you translate this verse? We normally translate it as man was created in God's image. And that word has led us to enormous problems. Correct? So, what's our alternative? What is the Rambam saying? Both of them. Essentially, what do they share in common? What essentially to both of them is the word Selim referring to? Does it refer to the form of God? Does it refer to the image of God? And therefore the physicality of God? It refers to, you can't talk about the essence of God. Right? Can't talk about the essence of God. So what is it referring to?
Qualities of God.
Except that qualities would work, except that we can't really. What qualities of God are we talking about here?
Midos, sort of
the qualities? Midos are part of it. I would imagine. I need a word for tselem. If tselem, if I translate tselem as image, I'm in trouble. The Rambam went out of his way to say the word tselem in biblical Hebrew is not the same as tar. Tar would be image. When you talk about the image of somebody, the image that they portray or convey, you're talking about their outwardly physical appearance. Says the Rambam, that's exactly what the Torah is not talking about. We've turned our terminology backwards. So if tar is image, then what is tselem?
Could be actions.
Yeah. Could be actions. It's a hard word to translate as actions.
A mirror. He gives man the active intellect that gives it capable of making choices.
So now we could talk about active intellect.
Intelligence.
We could talk about intelligence.
Ability to choose.
Talk about choice. The only problem is none of those words naturally translate the word tselem.
So all giving, we have a chance to be all giving like God?
Certainly one of the attributes that we're talking about. I need a translation of the word tselem that would encompass it all. I'm looking for the translation with which to do this. People have been searching for this translation for generations. We understand that we think translations are nothing. Translations, to pick up a text and translate it. You translate this word wrong, and you will mislead generations of biblical students. Translate it right, and you can open up vistas. And it all boils down to translation of one word.
But you know,
behavior?
But I still need a word that's out.
Some things cannot be translated into one word.
Possibly.
Because God is all these things that we're talking about here, so you can't...
Good.
Humans can't.
So
we don't have the ability to combine this into one word.
Correct. So give me, nonetheless, let's go, we're going to try.
Perfection.
Active intellect. Intelligence. Choice. Perfection. They all share one thing in common. Attributes of?
Goodness.
Or aspects of God. So what do I do with tselem Elokim? Soul? Or spirit? Tselem Elokim. So I'll tell you what I think is the best translation to the phrase tselem Elokim that exists. And I cannot claim originality to it. I wish I could, because I can make a mint. But I stole it from Ayin Kaplan. Best Aya Kaplan. Aya Kaplan has a translation of Chumash. It's a very interesting translation. As I've said, every translation is a commentary. Aya Kaplan never wrote a commentary on Chumash, but he has a translation on Chumash, which is his commentary. And everybody looks at the footnotes, and they're tiny little footnotes. It's published in a book called The Living Torah. It's purple. It's right over there. And everybody looks at the footnotes. Forget the footnotes. The footnotes are secondary. His translation is mind-blowing. And he translates the word, the phrase "B'tzelem Elokim" as "in the spirit of godliness." There is no better translation than that. "Vayivra Elokim et Adam b'tzelmo," God created man in the spirit of godliness. It encapsulates the exact opposite of the phrase "the image of God." It is not God who looks like us. We are in his image, meaning look at us and you will see God. It is we who contain within us some component of the godly. God has put into us, Vayipach be'apon nishmat chayim, God has blown into us some kind of life, some part of Him. In Kabbalistic literature, it's called Chelek Eloka Mima'al, some aspect of God Himself, some spark, and it's also the term, some aspect that we call it the soul or the spirit, whatever the term is. It's hard to define because it's hard to define God. But it is that aspect of the human being which is not physical, not scientifically measurable. And the scientists have been looking for it for generations, for years. They won't find it. The moment they push the envelope, we will move the marker again. Because it is clear to us that there is some aspect of the human being that is not physical and that cannot be measured in a laboratory. Whatever you call it the freedom of choice, call it the abstract thinking of the intellectual human, of the intellect, at every generation we will define it differently. But it is undefinable because God is undefinable. That's Tzelem Elokim. It's the godliness within the human being. Dafka, the non-physical. So the very point of challenge, we started with this verse as a challenge to us. We said, why can't we say God is physical? After all, the human being is created in the image of God. Clearly, God therefore must be physical in some way. According to this understanding, it's the exact opposite. The verse speaks of exactly what the Rambam is referring to. The fact that the human being is part of the animal kingdom, part of the physical world. But the human being is a combination. Every other creature comes from the physical world. The story of creation describes the human being as created as a synthesis of two forces, the physical and the non-physical. And if you look at the story of creation in chapter 2, you see it quite explicitly. Vayitza Hashem Elokim et ha'adam afar min ha'adamah. God formed the human being in the formation, the physical formation, dust of the earth. Vayipach be'apav nishmatri. And then blew into him some from God himself. Blew into him. When you blow something of yourself. You exhale part of that which is inside you. You bring into the human being some aspect of the godly, some aspect of the spirit, of the non-physical. And that's precisely what the word Tzelem Elokim is trying to convey. That the human being alone in creation, axiomatic, human being alone in creation, carries within him that spark of godliness, that Tzelem Elokim. So I found this translation many years ago, and I have used it ever since. The translation of Tzelem Elokim as the spirit of godliness, rather than the image of God. It says 180 degrees, says the exact opposite of what the translation means. Question.
Extraterrestrials, we're assuming here, I'm just trying to be I'm challenging you to say that we're assuming that everything that we see is all we have.
No, I never said that.
We'll find something that also has spirit of godliness that won't.
There's absolutely nothing that I have said here that would counteract or contradict that postulation.
So at some point, when we, with all these satellites pointing up and listening to the heavens, we presume that we hear something from another world. It could have godliness in it.
Absolutely. No reason to assume not. The only thing the Torah ever says is that in the world in which we exist here, we are the only creatures created with a Tzelem Elokim. Doesn't say. The Torah explicitly tells us nothing about what exists in the world beyond the domain of the globe in which we live. And that's the opening verse of creation. Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim ve'et ha-aretz. We make the mistake of translating shamayim as heaven. That's another mistranslation. Shemayim has nothing to do with heaven. The word Shemayim literally means
water.
So there's actually two translations. So one translation is Shamayim, water. separate land from water, right? Upper waters, lower waters, the domain of the clouds, if you will. The other translation is that of the Sforno, to be consistent, which translates the word Shemayim Sham times two. What's a hand in Hebrew?
Yad.
Yad. What's two?
Yadayim.
What's a foot in Hebrew? What's two? Raglayim. What, you understand the pair concept of biblical grammar? Right? Ayin, enayim. Ozen, oznayim. Sham, there. Doubly there, shamayim. Meaning, says this Sforno, the word Shemayim refers to that which was out of our domain. God created two domains, our domain and the domain beyond. And the rest of the creation story? Bereshit Elokim et haShamayim et haAretz. He created Shemayim and he created Aretz. He created our world and he created it there. What's the next verse? VeAretz hayta tohu vavohu. The rest of Chumash is about the Aretz. When do we ever go back to the discussion of Shemayim? We don't. All we know about it is that it exists. Some say it's a reference to Olam Haba, some say it's a reference to the rest of the universe. Who knows what it's a reference to? But it's clear from the Torah's description of creation that there's something created to which the Torah does not go back to. There's nothing that I understand in the world of Torah that would negate the notion of extraterrestrial existence. We don't know.
How does the rest of creation live if it isn't through the spirit of some type of godliness?
There's, again, so then I go back to this notion of three types of ruach. Ruach, nefesh, and neshama. Every living thing has some kind of nefesh and neshama. If you want to look at it from the perspective of vegetation, animal, and human being. Vegetation has one level of life force in it. Animal kingdom has another level of life force in it. The human being has tzel melekim. If you want to look at it from the point of view of the stages of creation, if the description of creation is a description of stages. It's actually description even, it's even more interesting. It's a description of the laws that govern each stage. It's not even a description of that which is, but the laws that govern each stage. The Torah says, Tadsheha arad desha. Let the land give forth vegetation. That's a rule. That's a concept. It doesn't mean that the vegetation grew. It means that God created the rule, the principle, that land would produce vegetation. But the stages, day three is vegetation, and day four is cosmos, day five is animal kingdom. Day six is human being. So the stages. Okay? Now, what we have not completed today, and we will, B'ezrat Hashem, do next week, is a discussion of the implication of all of this. So man has a soul, and therefore, why? Why is it necessary to create the human being, dafka, as a synthesis of the physical and the non-physical? It's very important for us to understand that concept. It'll lead us to everything else that comes afterwards. So we will spend next week's class discussing that piece of it, and then we will continue from there.